Pat Egan is one of Ireland's top concert promoters with over 50 years of experience in the Irish music scene. He's written a book. He has. And I'm delighted to say that it's called Backstage Pass, A Life in Show Business by pioneering music and concert promoter Pat Egan, who joins me on the phone right now. Pat, it's good to talk to you. How are you?
Great, Ger. Great. Nice to talk to you.
Good. Pat, it must be a very big book, is it? Because you've done it all. You've done it all.
No, it's not a big book. Writing a book was never my intention. Like everybody else, I got caught up in the COVID, and I wasn't a writer anyway. I did a few things for Spotlight years ago, but I left school with very, very poor English.
Right.
Spelling and punctuation and all that stuff. So I wanted, if I was going to do it, I wanted to do it myself in my own way. The publisher did say to me that maybe you'd use a ghostwriter. I said, no, I don't want that, because they wouldn't understand where I'm coming from, and okay, couldn't get it across.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want a show business book that was all nice and sweet and softly. I wanted to put in the things about the people I'd met that were good, and also the things that I experienced that were different or negative or whatever the word I'm looking for is.
They say there's no business like show business, but it's a murky business, isn't it?
It is, very much so. It is, yeah. It's a cruel business as well, in terms of how the chances fall to various artists and things like that. There are so many really talented people, great songwriters, singers, musicians, whatever, and they just aren't standing in the right place at the right time in a lot of cases. So I wouldn't be recommending anyone going into show business now. Certainly at the kind of stuff that I did, there is no opportunity anymore. Opportunity has ceased to exist. Yeah. Because of the way it's become kind of globalized, or, with big American companies pulling all the strings. That wasn't the way when I started in the 60s. I could go over to London and I could knock on one of 20 or 30 show business offices with managers of people or variety companies and things like that, and I could go in and talk to people about the various acts, and like I did with someone like Shirley Bassey, who was a major star in the 60s and 70s, and it was by putting my head around the door that I kind of got a lot of the gigs. You can't do that now. There is no door to put your head around anymore.
Yeah, they kind of, the artist managers kind of say, look, we're going to take you on tour in Europe. And so they look for venues in Ireland and England and Spain and France and Germany and all of those places. And they just put them in there. So as you say, the job of the Irish promoter is very much waning at this stage. But how did I know that you were at this? Sorry, I only realized, having read this, the information that Anya sent to me, that you were a disc jockey, a DJ in Radio Caroline back in the 60s.
Well, I went out to Radio Caroline, but I did a very short stint there. I was good at what I did on the stage. I knew my records well. I knew all the background to, if I was introducing a record, I would have known who produced it and who the lead singer in the group was, whether it was the Temptations or whether it was the Mersey Beats or whoever it was. But I always suffered from a lack of confidence and a nervous disposition. So Caroline didn't work out for me, much to my disappointment, but at the same time, it opened other doors as well.
I mean, when you think about it, the job that I'm doing right now, the job that you were doing on Caroline, you're sitting in an empty room on your own, talking into a piece of metal and hoping that somebody at the other side would hear it. And that made you nervous, but yet you were able to knock on the doors of the big managers of the big show stars, and you were able to talk to them and get them to Ireland.
I don't know what it was. I could get up on the stage in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people fairly easy and introduce acts, which I did for Spotlight magazine for years when we used to do our various pole concerts and things. But whatever it was about the, the studio, it didn't work for me. Maybe I just couldn't drum up the right ambience or atmosphere or whatever in relation to getting myself across. I'd get tongue-tied and whatever. And so it didn't work out on the radio. But like I said, it led to other opportunities.
Are you the man, the promoter that paid you two 50 quid for a gig?
I did. Well, indeed, paid him 50 quid. But it was... they were only a young band at the time. Yeah. They hadn't been signed. I don't think Paul McGuinness was involved with them even at that stage. They were just one of the new bands around Dublin. There was a whole new generation of bands around Dublin at that time.
Yeah.
They were looking for a support gig. They knew the Stranglers would have the house full, and there was 2,000 people in the ballroom in the Top Hat in Dunleary, and they opened. So they weren't interested, really. I'm not saying they didn't take the 50 quid, but they were more interested in getting the exposure, and that's what it was about.
Fantastic. I know that, again, the information that was sent to me, the book talks about you trying to avoid the great white sharks at the top of the Irish music business. Are we talking about then, or are we talking about back in the 1980s, 90s, 2000s?
No, more so now, much more so nowadays.
Okay.
It's when promoters start to control theatres and stuff, it becomes much more difficult for an independent guy to make. First of all, you're up against it on a number of fronts, and you won't get any kind of priority in relation to dates. And also, it's a much more difficult thing. If you own the venue, you can control the costs a little bit more. But when you're going in somewhere and somebody says the rent is $8,000 or whatever, and they don't want to give you a Saturday night, obviously, if they have shows themselves. So that's a new kind of thing where promoters control the venues, which makes it another hurdle for young people to cross if they're trying to get into the business as a promoter, you know?
Right. And tell me, how did you get into promoting to start with, going back to the start of this whole thing?
Well, I left school at just before my 14th birthday, went to work as a messenger boy in a hardware firm, and I stayed there for 4 years doing various things, being a stock control clerk at the end. And it was in Smithfield Square in Dublin, and around my 18th birthday, I remember they were making a movie outside called The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, and they'd built a replica Berlin Wall, and I could see when I'd finish work in the evenings, I didn't go home immediately. I'd hang around the film set, and I saw Richard Burton and Claire Bloom, people getting ready for a shoot and things like that.
Yeah.
And I just got into it kind of that way, bit by bit. Show business fascinated me, the beautiful women fascinated me, the music and the whole lot, and it just tags onto you. And even though I had no musical talent whatsoever, I was hooked by the great stars in that period, you know, Roy Orbison, Billy Fury, Gene Pitney, all those terrific, terrific names.
You've worked with fabulous people like Billy Connolly, and Billy did the foreword for you in this particular book. Our own Brendan O'Carroll, Freddie Starr, the late Freddie Starr, Van Morrison, Phil Lynott, Paul McGrath, U2, Eric Clapton, Marianne Faithfull. The list is endless, endless. And I love the story in the book about yourself and Van travelling to Cork. Tell us that story, the 160-mile
well,
journey.
Coming back from Cork, I did one of the first early tours with Van Morrison. We played the Cork City Hall, and we played the stadium in Dublin. Boxing Stadium, and honestly, I had been down in Cork to meet Van arriving and doing the gig and travelling back to Dublin. I decided I'd go back with him in the limo, and he just didn't open his mouth for the whole almost 4 hours. In fact, he didn't even say hello to me. He kind of grunted at me or whatever, and that was it. He sat in the front of the car, I sat on the back, and he didn't say a word, not a word the whole way. But I wasn't bothered. I'm not that type of person who takes anything. You know, I wasn't insulted in any way. I was a huge fan of Van's, and I still am today. I still think he's probably the most talented artist that we've ever produced. Okay, some of the stuff over the years has gone a bit too jazzy for me or whatever. I like his Moon Dance and his Brown Eyed Girl and Caravan and all that kind of stuff. So I bumped into him a few times after that, and he invited me to dinner, and then he sent me home without having dinner. So he was staying at a house out in Navan, and he had called Spotlight magazine. I thought it was a couple of lads in there playing a joke on me, but it was actually Van was on the phone. He said, "Will you come out and have dinner this evening?" And at first I couldn't make out what he was saying. I asked him to repeat it, which he did. So I was absolutely delighted. I'd been writing about him when no one else was, certainly the first journalist in this side of the world. I call myself a journalist there. That's
all right.
I'm not a journalist. I'm an outlaw. But anyway, I went to see him down in a country house in Navan. I remember driving, and a nice lady opened up and said, "Mr. Morrison," a housekeeper, I think she was, or a cook or whatever she was. She said, "Mr. Morrison will be with you shortly." Mm-hmm. And she brought me into the dining room. I was there about a half an hour or so, and I wondered what was happening. And then she came back and she said, "I'm awfully sorry." She said, "Mr. Morrison's not having dinner tonight." So he didn't even come down the stairs to shake my hand and say he wasn't feeling well or anything. Oh. It was just kind of feck off and go home, you know, which it was.
But
that was Van Morrison. And, you know, to this day, I would never hold it against him. I don't hold things against anybody, regardless. Yeah. I just don't have that in my nature, whether it was someone who I got a raw deal from in the end or whatever. That was it, you know.
Having said that about Van, you also tell the story that in 1967, while writing for Spotlight, you received two copies of Brown Eyed Girl, along with a letter from Van thanking you for his support. Yeah. And go on.
The record was just out. It had just come out in the States. It probably hadn't even gone out to radio stations at the time. And I got a parcel arrived at the thing in the Spotlight office. There was a copy of Blown Your Mind, which was the first album on Bang Records, and then there was two copies, two 7-inch single copies of Brown Eyed Girl, and a nice little note from Van just saying thanks for all the support or whatever it is. So he did have a heart after all, if you know what I mean, though no one could find it. I played those records in the Five Club in Harcourt Street until they were pretty much worn out or whatever. And it was way before, at that stage, Brown Eyed Girl was just starting to climb the American charts. It got to about number 5 or 6, I think, in the end. And it has been probably Van Morrison's anthem, or his most kind of recognized standard song, you know, over the years.
That's right.
And it's still a brilliant song today, you know.
A friend of mine told me he was at some live gig some years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, and Van Morrison came on stage, and the first song he sang was Brown Eyed Girl, and the place went ballistic. And when he was finished, when he was finished singing it, he said, "No, that's that out of the way. Let's have fun."
Yeah.
He just obviously felt he had to sing it, and that was it.
Yeah, I think a lot of acts are like that when they're with one song or whatever, you know. But that was how it was with Van. And I was trying to put together a new venue in University College Dublin, but the COVID has pretty much knocked it on the head on me.
Okay.
And I was opening in April next. Paul Brady had agreed to play the first night, and I was trying to get Van for the second night, but I haven't heard back from them at this point. But I don't think we'll have any concerts next year at all. I mean, we'll have concerts, but you won't have concerts for middle-aged 40-year-olds upwards. I don't think those people are going to come back into a big room with another 1,000 people until all this is out of the way. I think there's a lot of people who are very scared. Certainly, I've seen a lot of them in the last few weeks in Dublin.
Right. Okay. We'll come back to that before we finish, if that's all right. I want to talk to you about the people that you would have met down through the years, the stars that we'd all know, and some of the little foibles, the little queer things that you were asked to do, or that were... I know the story of Julio Iglesias. Tell us that, because the Spanish audience might be interested in this.
Well, Julio Iglesias was 2012 or 13, I can't remember. He's very much at the end of his popularity. He had he had toured internationally or whatever a lot at that time, and I was offered him. He was touring Europe, and it seemed like a good deal, even though he wasn't near as hot as he used to be. But mm-hmm. they asked for $250,000 flat fee, which is unusual.
Okay.
And I thought, I did up the figures, and I thought if we did 60% business in the Tree Arena, we would make X amount of money.
Mm.
Unfortunately, he only did about 35% business, and I lost about $185,000 or whatever.
Okay.
But that's the kind of money, that would be standard kind of money for losing on big gigs. If you run a show in the Tree Arena and you don't get your numbers, you could be looking at anything between, 150 to 500,000 on a gig. So that's how it's all changed. But Julio was, it was a real experience. He arrived on a private jet with about 18 people, I think, in total. The girl in charge didn't like the color of the SUVs that we put on. She said they had to be black. They were dark blue, actually, and they were brand new, which she said, please have them changed. Julio doesn't drive Julio only drives in black transport. I had a van there to take his fridge off the airplane. He had brought his own wine with him, and there was a van there to collect the fridge. He didn't stay. He stayed in the Shelburne, but went home very early in the morning, 4 o'clock or whatever. He just wanted to get out of Dublin because the show was a disaster as well. He got through it, but okay. He sang an awful lot of Spanish songs. He got through it, but it wasn't for me. I enjoyed the experience of dealing with, on two levels, you work with someone like Billy Connolly, who's probably got the most famous face in the world, certainly in the English-speaking world, and then you deal with Julio. Julio was everything you expect a superstar to be and to want, and how they think. Billy Connolly was the complete opposite, even though he was the last time, I think, in Dublin. We did his very last show of his career in 2017, 18, before the Parkinson's diagnosis, and Billy played to 27,000 people in Dublin in three nights. And he would still arrive at the airport on his own. He'd carry a bag. He'd have the banjo in one hand and the bag in the other. And he looked like a hippie, an actual 60s kind of hippie most of the time. He was a banjo playing kind of hippie. He didn't want that star treatment, and he never asked for it, and he never expected it. He just liked to be able to saunter around the place himself and meet people and just be a folky as he was. He used to say to me, I couldn't, if Ronnie Drew saw me arriving in a limo, or he saw me with people,
entourage.
Entourage, yeah, he'd say to me, what's, you losing the plot here, Billy, or whatever, because they were folkies, all those guys, and Billy loved them, really loved the Irish guys. He loved Jay Healy, he loved Eddie Fury, Ronnie, John Sheehan, Barney, the whole lot of them. He absolutely adored them. And when he'd be in town, one of the first things he always says to me is, how is Ronnie or how is Barney?
Yeah.
And make sure you let them know I'm in the Gresham and we can have an afternoon tea. And he was a great man for afternoon tea, especially when he gave up the drink. Afternoon tea was his big his big treat in the day. Yeah, he loved scones that were properly cooked. He was very fussy about his scones. If they weren't light and fluffy, he would complain about them. So he was an absolute specialist in scones and strawberry jam or whatever.
Beautiful.
So it's simple things. It's amazing that you think something like that, but he loved his scones, yeah.
Lou Reed asked you to do a favour for him one time. What was that?
Well, I probably did that favour for quite a few guys over the years. I certainly did it for Freddie Starr a couple of times. And there would have been some naughty ladies arriving, probably for some of Eric Clapton's band as well.
Mm.
Lou Reed just came off the plane, came through the came through the customs or whatever, and we said, welcome, Lou, or whatever, and he put his arm around my shoulder. He said, I want you to do me a favor. He says, a special lady arriving from Amsterdam tonight. I want you to pick her up yourself. And I said, well, the show will be on. He said, that doesn't matter. You pick her up. So while the show was on in the stadium in Dublin, I was standing at Dublin Airport waiting for a lady from Amsterdam or whatever to arrive.
And when a show is on like that, Pat, you're there. You have to be there because, you know, anything can go wrong in a live gig. And I suppose on a night like that when you had to leave, were you kind of apprehensive or had you enough people around?
No, I would. Obviously, I'd like to be at the gig, but when the guy on the stage asks you to do something, you try to do it. It's not part of the show by any means. And an awful lot of that stuff wasn't part of the show, you know. Going around billiard halls in the night time looking for a football table for Eric Clapton at 11:30 to midnight because he fancied one. And then when we did get one for him and had it carried down Stephen's Green by four guys and dumped on the floor in the Shelburne, he'd fallen asleep and didn't want it then. So you had all that kind of stuff. It was a hugely exciting time, but I didn't realize that because you're young in those days and you just get on with what you're doing and you just accept whatever the rules are. And in a lot of cases in the concert business in those early days, there were no rules. There were no rules for, you know, license for a gig. If it was an outdoor gig, no health and safety, no nothing. You just flew by the seat of your pants and you hope for the best. And in my case, I was extremely lucky.
And hoping for the best included at times, hoping that you'd stay alive, because part of the book deals with you staying alive in the nightclub business in the 80s and the 90s and facing serious protection rackets.
Yeah, Dublin in the 80s was a dangerous place to be. It was a dangerous city because it was the period before all the new criminal laws were introduced, where, you know, the cab and all that stuff, and where before Veronica Gerwin was shot. And there were robberies every day or every other day, certainly, whether it was banks or, you know, or bookies or whatever it was. And nightclubs were a special kind of attraction for guys who were chasing a lot of cash or whatever it was. So that was how it was. You operated in it and you just hoped that to stay under the radar or whatever. But I got caught badly going to the bank one Sunday morning. It was Saturday night, Sunday morning, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., when we drove up O'Connell Street into Henry Street and up towards the bank in Capel Street. And suddenly a car came flying out of a side alleyway and hit our car right at the boot, basically. Okay. And swung us around a full circle or whatever. And the guy just jumped out with a balaclava on him, and he had a shotgun up in his hand, and he put it up to the window. He said, give me the shout, give me the money, give me the money. And I was, I don't know, I was just stuck.
Stunned.
Dead at the time. I didn't know what to do. When I did get out of the car, I dropped the bag on the floor, on the ground by accident, because I was shaking so much.
Right.
And, you know, had I been, as I said in the book, had I been someone like Steven Seagal or whatever, I would have been able to floor the guy after I dropped the bag. But that was never going to happen. And then there was a second car that was with us, had the bouncers in it, and they had a second. We'd done extremely well that particular weekend.
Right.
The bouncers had a second bag, they got that as well, so we lost about 8,000 quid or whatever, which was big money in 19, you know, when was it? No, 1989, 1990.
Would you do it all again?
If the conditions and everything was the same, I wouldn't do it in today's world or today's it wouldn't work today. I was just lucky. I was one of probably only a couple of people who had an opportunity to get into show business. Working in Spotlight magazine was, you know, at that time there hadn't been a magazine of any kind of teenage magazine of any kind of substance or whatever in the 60s. So getting into spotlight and being involved with all those legendary characters, all those famous managers, you know, the Jim Hands and the Oliver Berries and TJ Burns and all that stuff. That was, it was, you couldn't learn, if you were a streetwise, you couldn't learn from a better bunch of, you know, as I used to call them, rednecks, you know?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Because they had it all, sussed or whatever. So it was, to be a part of it was very special.
One of the important things for a promoter is that you're promoting somebody who's well known, and a key to that is, particularly for a singer, would be having their music played on the radio, wherever it is. And I know that in your book, that you take a look at that, and you talk about how young musicians or young acts are treated and how they can't get their music played on Irish commercial radio. Yeah. That's a big problem, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and it's a total injustice for it's one of those things, and because we've never had an arts minister with any awareness of the entertainment industry and how it works and how it operates, we have all these commercial radio stations who play basically playlists that are pretty much the same as the ones in the UK with a few tweaks. Yep. They might stick in somebody like, you know, Picture Disc or some of those new bands, like, oh, there's a lot of new bands out there, but they would play some of those bands because the music comes from a UK record company or whatever. Yep. But if you're an Irish artist and you're a new Christy Moore or a new, as Phil Coulter used to say, had I written The Town I Love So Well in the last 10 years, he said, you could forget about it. Yes. The song would never have become a classic or whatever. And it's a terrible shame. Radio RTE does what it can. It doesn't have enough radio time. 2FM should be an Irish music station. That's how I feel. Mm. And it should concentrate, you know, on new Irish music, on classic gold Irish music, on folk, on the whole lot. And it should be totally devoted to Irish music, because as it stands at the moment, it's just another copy of a UK radio station, which, you know, and I'm against that. Radio 1 does its best, but there's not enough music on Radio 1, and RTE television does very much feature new Irish artists.
It does. All right, tell me, have you a favourite artist that you worked with? Is there one person stands out that you'd say, that was my favourite?
Well, my favorite artist of all time is Roy Orbison, and I didn't, even though he came to Ireland during the 60s, and I know he played a lot of ballrooms and things around the country, I never actually got to meet him. And I still love his music today, and I love the fact that he was able to move into that kind of traveling Wilburys thing and create more great music with you know, iconic musicians, George Harrison and the rest of them. So as an artist, that would be my favorite. In terms of I never got to promote Dusty Springfield, who I also was a huge fan of.
Right.
So of the ones that I promoted, I suppose in terms of the actual music, it would be Eric Clapton, there'd be Gene Pitney, you know, Al Martino, George Martin, and all that kind of stuff. I'm very much a one-song kind of person. Even in my younger days, I didn't buy that many albums. I bought an awful lot of singles, and they were all, you know, if I had an album, it was a greatest hits album, a classic hits album, or whatever it was. So I wasn't, I was brought up on the one song, the first song I ever heard that absolutely blew me away was Save the Last Dance for Me by the Drifters, which came out in 1960, I think.
Right. Wow, okie dokie. All right, is there anybody you wouldn't work with again?
No, not at all.
Really?
If anybody came around, well, I don't think so. There's nobody that I wouldn't. I'm as I said earlier, I'm the kind of person who lets bygones be bygones. I don't hold any kind of grudges with anybody or whatever. And I always tried in, excuse me again, I always tried in all my dealings to be, to make sure everybody got a cut. Because nowadays that doesn't happen. There's no such thing now as a deal where everybody makes a few bob. It's all about the big guy taking 99.9% of what money's on the table, and the rest of you can feck off, you know? And that's the sad thing about it now, is that the opportunity to develop new shows or new things or whatever is restricted because of the way the market has developed or whatever. You know, there's no, there's just so little opportunity to stage the music that I kind of got into earlier on, that kind of, I won't call it cabaret stuff, but there was a lot of that kind of middle of the road singers, the Shirley Bassey's, all that kind of people. They've all disappeared now completely. They were, that was all replaced by X Factor and stuff like that. And then you have all these people who's got their 10 minutes of fame and are forgotten then almost as quick. And they're not, they can't get any work. It's very, very hard for artists to get work now.
It is.
Really, really difficult for young people to get work. If you're in a rock band, you have some hope of breaking through or whatever. But if you're a solo performer, you know, how many Ed Sheerans will come around? Probably only one in every 50 years, you know?
That's it.
So it's hard to make money, even for the bands that are out there. It's the bands at the top, you know, like the Eagles and the U2s and the Coldplays and all that. Those bands make enormous amounts of money when they tour. But other bands at a level just below that are touring, and they're not really making any money because the cost of touring is just ginormous. You know, it's you get, first of all, if you're taking in 100 grand, the first 10,000 or 11,000 goes to Ticketmaster. You then have to pay your PRS of 3% or 3.5%. You then have all the other costs related to putting the gig on. Before you get near the musicians or the technical end of people, your venue will cost you 25 or 30% of the 100 grand. So it's by the time everything is paid and the money is put on the table for the artist at the end, out of that 100 grand, if he gets 10 grand or 12 grand, he's doing really well.
And you're the last person to be paid.
The promoter's always the last person. They don't even, it's getting now to the point where they don't even, in America now, the artists like the Eagles and the big ones, they get all the money from the gig. Every penny that comes in on the door now goes to the big acts. There's no percentage for the promoters. The Ticketmaster, the Live Nation and the Ticketmaster, that's where the money is for the promoter. It's in the ticket price. That's why you end up paying, you know, charges on a 100 quid ticket. If you're going to the Eagles and you're paying 100 quid in, well, 16 or 17 quid of that is going to the promoter on the tickets.
Right.
And he has to split it with Ticketmaster and everybody else. It's just a different ball game. There's no chance. As I ran gigs way back where I had a chance of making in one night 20 or 30, 40,000 quid even, which we did and quite a few times in the 60s and 70s. You haven't a chance. There's no chance in the world.
No.
You have a better chance of winning the lotto.
Are you hanging up your hat now at this stage, or are you still active?
Well, there's no market out there. There's nothing to do. I'm getting old, and I have to realize when you get to a certain point that you're out of you're past your sell-by date and you're out of commission. You know, so that's how it is. And because the market that I do specialize in is for older people. And they're being very cautious. I can't see, as I said, you know, and you can't run a gig with 300 people in a big room or 500 people or even 800 people. If the room takes 1,000 or 1,100 people, you have to have it full, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise, you lose your shirt.
Well, look, the name of the book is Backstage Pass. The amount of information I got in advance of chatting with you told me that there was going to be an extensive interview and I could chat to you for much longer, but you've given me a huge amount of time. We're at 35 minutes almost at this stage, so I do appreciate you taking the time.
You're very welcome.
Backstage Pass, A Life in Show Business, written by pioneering music and concert promoter Pat Egan. Pat, I only play Irish music on Live on Era, so will you pick an Irish artist that you'd like me to play a track from, and I'll play something from them?
I would like a Paul Brady track or a Sinead Lohan track.
Excellent. Thanks very much. And we wish you and yours a very happy Christmas and a great 2022 as well. Pat Egan, thanks for talking to us today.
That's all.